episode 4 of A Legitimate Salvage, a podcast about The Expanse in which four friends slash Doctor Who fans attempt to rewatch seasons 1 to 3 before the season 4 premieres on Amazon in December. Will we make it?
I'm Warren Fry.
I'm Jen Burt.
I'm Chip Sutter.
And I am Katie Burt. So we are going to be talking about episodes, is it 5 and 6 of the season?
No.
Yeah, it is 5 and 6. Oh, no, it isn't.
6 and 7? 7 and 8. It's gone
seven and
fast.
Eight.
Whatever they were, it was, you know, I think we all agree it was when this season really kicked into high gear. We have a lot to discuss about these two episodes. Generally, like, how did you all feel about this pairing of episodes?
They're kicking into high gear at this point.
Welcome to The Expanse, everybody.
Yeah. They're kind of getting their act together. Like, we're done with the preamble.
Oh, yeah. It felt like it really hits its stride in these episodes. Everything really starts to come together.
Yeah. And
literally so.
Yes.
Literally. I think also as someone who, when I watched this the first time around, there was a break between the early episodes before I finished watching the season. I was surprised how quickly things happened. Like, I thought these things happened later in the run of the show. So it was really cool to just dive into these for rewatches for this podcast episode and to realize that we are already at this point in the story.
Well, realizing that we only have two more episodes after these two that we just watched till the end of the first season just seemed like, oh, wow, it's really happening.
Yeah. And the other thing that got me is, you know, towards the end of Salvage, well, not towards the end of Salvage, it's actually literally midway through Salvage, you're reminded that this whole series started with a woman busting out of a container and seeing blue goo that was eating people. Mm-hmm. And we saw the blue goo again. And suddenly what's felt really grounded and near future that we've been talking about before has suddenly gotten weird and creepy and alien again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and before we dive into discussing these episodes more in depth, let's go through some of the big plot points from Windmills and Salvage. Chip, if you want to take it away.
Absolutely. So Windmills first aired on January 19th of 2016, and three main plot lines here. Joe Miller is officially in sad sack territory. So what do you do when you've been fired for investigating a conspiracy? You mope. You confront Anderson Dawes, who tried to kill you but now doesn't think you're worth attention. But you'll come around to the OPA's way of thinking eventually. You break into Julia Mao's apartment. You get a call from your guy that the mystery ship Anubis that Julie was checking out never made it to Eros, but its shuttle did. You totally cash in all of your chips, and you fly coach to Eros. Our hero, Joe Miller. Meanwhile, Christian of Asrala visits Holden's mother to try to make sense of Holden's psychology. It turns out, Holden has an overactive sense of responsibility, and he was raised to be a crusader. Christian figures he's no terrorist, but Secretary Ehrenreich counters that before their spy went silent, the spy figured out Holden's on a mystery mission in a Mars gunship converted by the OPA. Seems a little suspicious to Ehrenreich, so he's sending black ops after Holden and company. And what about that wormy spy? He hitched a ride on the Rosinante before he was discovered and almost spaced by Amos. While they're on their way to find the last survivor of the Scopuli, a Mars patrol intercepts them. The spy convinces them to find the spy codes that Naomi hacks into at the last minute, which convinces the Martians that the Rosinante is actually doing deep cover work for Mars. All in all, it's a ubiquitous, mendacious, polyglottal episode with a couple of donkey balls.
Yikes.
And that was Windmills. Sorry, Warren, I didn't mean to damage your sensibilities there.
Yes, I'm quite a pure little boy.
Yeah, shall I move on to Salvage?
Please do.
Sure.
That was Warren's January 26th.
Yeah, no, it's embracing myself.
So Salvage was first aired on January 26th, 2016, and it does, in fact, literally all come together. Miller's steerage flight to Eros includes a talk with a Mormon about faith, and I guess Julie Mao's the only thing Miller believes in now. He hooks up with his friend, Inspector Simitimba, and tracks Shuttle Anubis 1A to the Blue Falcon Hotel, and security camera video reports OPA Lionel Polanski is actually Julie Mao herself. She doesn't look too well. She's registered at the Blue Falcon Hotel. All of this will be important soon. Meanwhile, tensions are rising between Earth, Mars, and the Belt. An Earth warship is heading for Tycho Station because they think Holden's an OPA terrorist operating under Fred Johnson's orders. And Christian of Arsala finds out her old friend, the ambassador to Mars, has killed himself. Meanwhile, the Rocinante crew finds a stealth ship hidden on an asteroid. Turns out, it's the Anubis. Turns out, one survivor powered down and vented the ship and escaped in a shuttle. Turns out, it's the ship we saw Julie in before the opening credits of Episode 1. Turns out, it's a bad idea to power up the Anubis because that blue goop that seemed to be eating a person in Episode 1 feeds off the reactor. The crew escapes and Holden orders the Anubis's destruction. They follow the shuttle's trail to Eros and trace Lionel Polanski to the Blue Falcon Hotel. However, now that that wormy spy guy has a cell phone signal, he calls in the Black Ops hit in the hotel lobby. Earth operatives arrive, a shootout begins, and the shootout ends when Joe Miller gets involved and helps take them down. They all together find Lionel/Julie's hotel room and discover she's dead and gruesomely covered with the same blue stuff that was on the Anubis. Joe Miller finds out that faith is a funny thing. And that was two big, honking, mendacious episodes of The Expanse.
Yeah, thanks for
and
that.
We're almost to the end of the season.
Thanks for that, Chip. There's so many nouns that I feel like I need to look up when I write about this show. And you have them all in there. The Blue Falcon Hotel. Lionel Polanski. So for those who haven't listened to our podcast before, for the first half of our episodes, we attempt to discuss these episodes without dropping spoilers for episodes past season 1, episode 8, which is what we're discussing up to in this episode. So we've all watched through season 3, but we know that some people are trying to catch up before, season 4 premieres. So we don't want to exclude those listeners. So for the first half of this episode, we will try to discuss without giving any information past where we're at now. And we'll be sure to let you know when we are entering the spoiler zone. So rewatchers like ourselves, be sure to stick around for that discussion. So we already discussed, briefly how these episodes really work on multiple levels and are highly watchable. And for me, one of those things that works so well, especially about Windmills, is how much of a great Amos episode this is. He's just been a low-key, awesome character from day one and really nails who his character is. But you don't know a lot about him, or he doesn't get as much of a meaty plot line until this episode. He even name-drops his character's own novella, The Churn, which tells the story of Amos's earlier life in Baltimore in this episode, even if it doesn't go into details about, a lot of the stuff that happens in that novella. So I'm curious for you guys, Amos is someone who obviously thinks of himself as lacking a moral compass, and that's something that comes up in this episode where Holden thinks that, Amos's choices are amoral or extreme. How do you guys feel about that? Do you think that Amos is a poor judge of character? Do you think that Naomi and others should be afraid of him?
It's tough because, he seems to actually be a good judge of character, but also has a trigger finger a mile wide. like in the second one here, he just blows people away with no problem whatsoever. And that's probably the right thing to do given the circumstances, but you're surprised at how little hesitation he has, I guess.
Yeah, I my notes for the second episode, I think I wrote down how many people did Amos kill/... like severely wounded,
at least two, if not
yeah,
three.
I think maybe three,
with very little information, really.
Yeah, he doesn't really know why these people are shooting at him necessarily, or what. He's just like, all right, we have to survive, and he really lays that out in Windmills. That is kind of his moral compass of like, how do I survive? Mm-hmm. But what I think I like about Amos in terms of how he is a judge of character is that he has a self-awareness whether he's a bad judge of character or not, he has a self-awareness of, like, there are maybe more compassionate ways to view the world and to make decisions, and he tries to seek out those people. And so while he definitely thinks Holden is kind of a fool in how kind of idealistic he is, I think he says something about how he hasn't risked anything or lost anything, I think he knows that he's trying to, I love about Amos is he is trying to be somewhat of a good person, which is really, yeah, admirable.
And I think he's...
He's not very good at it, but
no,
yeah.
No, he definitely falls down on this a lot.
I think he's better at it than he himself gives him credit for, and maybe, I don't know, at this point, Holden only has so much information about him, so I don't necessarily, you know, I don't blame Holden for viewing him in this way, although I do think it's interesting that when he talks to Naomi and he is like, get Amos under control, to me that means, like, partially, get him to listen to me, because he mm-hmm. does listen to Naomi, you know, and he, I don't know, for, I think one of the things I really like about Amos is that he seems to be very aware of where power lies and who has it and how they use it and who doesn't have it. And he doesn't always, it's not like he's, you know, always helping people who don't have power or, you know, just taking out people who abuse their power. But it seems like he's always aware of it, probably partially because of his upbringing. And that doesn't seem like a terrible lens through which to view the world.
No.
Yeah, he seems sympathetic to the little guy a lot more than most, even if he is a bit ruthless about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was that moment in the previous episodes where at the bar, where he warned a hustler that a potential client there was actually carrying a knife, you know, and he didn't need to do that, but he explained himself to Alex and said that, you know, this is little guys have to look out for each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's worth noting in the shootout scene that Miller kind of makes a similar choice as Amos in the sense that he comes in and maybe he doesn't kill people. Is that, I don't know if you guys remember, because he's just coming into a firefight and deciding very quickly who the good guys are and who the bad guys are.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Amos was in the firefight. Amos was, he's been here before. Yeah. He knows this sort of thing. So he recognizes a setup when he sees it. And at that point, you know, the switch flips in his mind and he's like, how do I get to my sidearm without triggering this stuff before I'm ready?
Let me slowly unzip my jacket.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's I don't want to say amoral, but he's ruthlessly analytical. And he is also, he not only knows himself really well, but he's got a strong sense of self-preservation. And so while I sympathize with Holden's, you know, sense of, like, moral authority, I guess. Well, sense of morality when they're anticipating the Mars Marines boarding the Rocinante. It doesn't feel like moral authority to me because Holden's just not thinking clearly. He's thinking emotionally, whereas Amos is just being real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I...
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that I feel like if he has a lack of empathy or, like, an ability to empathize, which maybe is what is going on there, I like that. I think a lot of times when you see that sort of thing portrayed in stories, it means that someone is, like, a villain or evil or, like, likes to cause pain. And I like that that absence doesn't have to mean, if that's what it is, doesn't have to mean, like, I will therefore cause pain and hurt other people for, you know, pleasure, which is, yeah.
Or as an excuse. Like, I think you often see that, well, I can't empathize with people. So if I just hurt other people, it's not my fault. And I think that he does.
He tries to create an accountability for himself.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is external because he feels like he doesn't have it internally. To interrupt you, Jen.
No, that's good.
The thing that I love about Amos versus Holden in these two episodes is Amos is an easy, tough guy. It just comes naturally for him. It's just who he is. In both of these episodes, Holden is constantly trying to toughen himself up. You know, there's this snarl when he orders the destruction of the Anubis that is like one half not great acting by Stephen Strait and one half I'm trying to be a bigger man. But you contrast his behavior with that wink that Amos gives when Holden introduces the spy to his new bodyguard. That wink, Amos's wink, is just utterly endearing, and it's just so sarcastic and funny.
I can't tell. Is
the
this,
moral authority?
Yeah. Oh, no, go sorry, for go it, ahead. Warren.
I was gonna say the moral authority thing is at the end where Holden does say nobody deserves this stuff, or like nobody should get access to this blue goop, whatever the hell it is. So there they just kind of do buy into his moral authority because he is taking a moral stand on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's not giving anybody the advantage, like, yeah, including themselves.
I think Holden is at his best when he's not putting on a show of bravado. He just doesn't have that.
Yeah, which isn't a bad thing.
He doesn't need it either.
Which I actually think it's interesting that this showdown that the two of them have when, you know, Holden pulls a gun on Amos, which in some ways just feels to me so out of character for Holden. Or maybe he's trying to put on a show, right? But like, I don't think I believe that he would shoot him. And so I think later on they kind of, without spoiling too much, they kind of get into a rhythm of playing to both their strengths as a crew, the two of them. Mm-hmm. And this just feels when they're at each other's throat, it just feels
the opposite of that.
Yeah, it just feels like Holden is so in over his head versus when he is.
They're still fumbling towards it.
Yeah, versus when he's doing some of these more kind of politicky kind of things, he does feel a little bit more at ease. These bigger moral questions that Amos is definitely not interested in.
And it is interesting for me to watch Amos in respect to Kenzo, the spy character, because, you know, he is unable to manipulate Amos in the same way that he's able to manipulate Holden, which is interesting. But also seeing these two characters who maybe on the surface look similar in the sense that they will do, you know, what it takes, but Amos, and can be brutal, but Amos, I don't know, there's like a lack of charade or manipulation to him that is like so refreshing. Mm-hmm. And I think just throws a lot of people off in a really delightful way. Just seeing him interact with pretty much any other character on the show is just, it's so fun to see them come up against that, because there's so many ways in which every other character and people in real life lie both to themselves and to other people, or, you know, have like degrees of truth. And to see a character who seemingly just says what he's thinking and is always like completely honest, like, we're going to kill you, buddy. he's fascinating to watch, both for himself and for what he brings out in other characters.
Yeah. I am the sort of person who in real life really shies away from big machismo-driven sort of high ego kinds of people.
Yeah.
I think you speak for this room,
my friend. Yeah, I mean, if I met Amos in real life, if I met a real life Amos, I would probably be put off by him.
Yeah, same.
I kind of want to be a Holden.
Yeah,
you know, the Crusader. Yeah. As we
and
get
I would
into.
I would be friends with Holden.
Yeah, but when I watch Amos and Holden and Kenzo, especially Kenzo, you know, when I watch the three of them on the screen, Amos is the one that I think I admire the most.
Yeah.
Because he's the most confident and he's the most true to himself. Kenzo's just a schemer, and Holden is just trying too hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's just so honest in a way that is so rare, and I agree. I admire it.
I kind of like Kenzo, though.
I just kept thinking that his eyes reminded me of Elijah Wood. I know that's a weird thing to say, but I was just like, I can't stop thinking about how his, like, eye section of his face reminds me of Elijah Wood.
I didn't notice that at all.
But I often have observations like this that people are like, that is not true. So if we have any listeners out there, please tell me if anyone else saw this.
Well, they also spent so much time focusing on his eyes because he has that, like, whatever cybernetic situation.
That's true. But, and cinematically, I did like when they, like, transferred to, like, the spy cam view, which they did sparingly, which is smart.
It frustrated me so much, though, because I was like, guys, this guy is, like, a spy, and you're not taking it seriously enough.
The thing about him is that he plays a similar but way tougher character in the Deus Ex games, and you're playing as him, and he does the voice, but it's a much more tough guy cyberpunk kind of a voice. So seeing him as a weasel really threw me off, and he kind of looks like the character too. They model it after the actor, but like more tough guy-ish. So it's really hard to wrap your head around if you've played these games and spent a lot of time in them, which I have. So
that's funny you say that, because there are two other supporting characters in these episodes that I knew from other things that distracted me a little bit. But we'll get to those later. So I keep coming back to this, but I just can't... I'm really fascinated with the idea of who actually is the captain and who holds power on the Rocinante. And there's this moment in this episode where... Windmills, where... Kenzo says, you tell your captain, and Holden immediately is just like, he's not our captain.
What do you mean, Amos?
Oh, yeah, Amos. And I think we always knew that Amos didn't consider Holden the captain. He does what Naomi thinks is right. But I was curious what everyone else thought about, do we think Holden is captain? Because there is this moment when they find the protomolecule where... I feel like Holden kind of just, lets Naomi take the lead. I don't know. Where do you... But I actually think that Alex is, like, Holden is our captain.
You know, I think in that... In Windmills, I think Amos is the captain.
Holden just thinks he is. He's kind of keeping at bay the biggest danger they have until the protomolecule shows up, right? So
there's also a part where they're communicating with the Martian ship and they're asking them to transmit the flight plan, and Alex just looks at Naomi and she nods. There's definitely who is in charge is a very nebulous.
It's a very flat team story.
Yes. I was going to say that, Chip. I think we should all take turns saying it every episode.
It's a good saying.
I'm sorry. Oh, by the way, everybody, new viewers, spoiler, that thing is called a protomolecule. You'll figure out what that means later.
Or maybe not. I'm still not really sure.
Yeah, like I keep thinking of the protomolecule in what's that anime? I can't remember. It's the not Gundam one from the 80s. But they also have protomolecule in that, so that threw me for a loop.
Robotech, whatever the real name is. Such a nerd. Yeah.
Protoculture. Yeah. What?
You're amongst friends.
I'm just as bad, but forgetful, so don't worry about that.
So we have this kind of heist moment in Windmills where they're trying to break into their own ship to find the Black Ops codes and to convince the Martians that, you know, they should leave them alone. They're up to very important Martian business. How was that sequence for you guys? Did it feel too convenient? Did it matter that it was felt too convenient?
It kind of felt a little added on, to be honest with you. Mm. Like, we need more tension, so let's do this, as opposed to it naturally ramping up like it does with the protomolecule.
There are a couple moments in this episode that felt like I was frustrated that they hadn't already investigated some of these parts of the ship. Like, they hadn't looked for something, like, codes like this. There was a point where he sends in the drones, and he's like, let me see what drones we have. Like, Alex wouldn't have already, like, investigated every cool feature of this ship. Or just...
I would have pressed every button.
Yeah. Like, come on.
But everything in space kills you, so don't press every button.
Yeah, so it
which
does
is
feel
why you
like...
should find the code so that you know which buttons not to press.
Well, yes.
Yeah, like they're hurting the characterization by having them not have like had checked out having checked out these things already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then I guess like
yeah.
they've had a lot going on, maybe.
They have, and strictly speaking, yeah, it kind of harms their characterization. On the other hand, they're discovering stuff at the same time that we are, and I don't mind that too much.
For me too, it was just the parallel editing between that part of it and the Holden Amos standoff was so good, because I was so invested in the Holden Amos standoff that I think it worked, like cutting away from that to have something else, and also just the fact that Alex ends up like prying the thing open with a crowbar was like my favorite part. And also that Naomi gets to, like, the whole time Kenzo is just having these little comments and Naomi's like, well, didn't think of that, like, you know, it was a stealth ship, didn't think of that we should turn off the power so it doesn't do this thing. And so I just liked that she got to be the competent breaker of things in that scene and, you know, do what she does best, be smart.
Mm-hmm.
And be in control of the situation at the last possible minute. So we also get the introduction of the something that will at some point be known as the protomolecule, or reintroduction. So watching this, I was thinking about how, you know, I was like, oh, the dramatic irony in this moment when you know what's happening, you know, not to go into spoiler, what's going to happen moving on. But I realized also that anyone watching this for the first time, and probably me the first time I watched it, getting that, like you were saying, Chip, payoff from what we saw in the first episode. Like, what did you guys think about the dramatic irony of them slowly investigating the ship? I think for me it dragged a little bit this time, but there is a dread that exists in those scenes when they're slowly moving through the scopuli and you're just, I was worried that something was going to, you know, jump out at them, even though I knew it wasn't.
Right.
I definitely had dread, and I also had, you've got a spy with you, so that kind of ups the stakes as well, because you don't know what that guy's going to do. It turns out nothing until they get to wherever the hell is Eros, but you don't know that at the time. Even though I actually did know that at the time, it still kind of bugs you, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think having both of those tensions really works. And I think the moment, like, how scared Holden and Naomi get once they realize what's happening is very effective. How quickly Holden is like, get out of here. Let's get out of here right now.
Yeah.
Really?
And this blue stuff doesn't do a whole lot. It just looks unearthly and weird and creepy. You know, they don't know what we know, which is in episode one, it was eating people. Did I mention that in all caps before?
At the end of the season, it's going to do some really crazy stuff.
So their reaction really just sort of sells it. They don't know what it is. They don't know what it does. They figure that it's some kind of bioweapon and then they blow it up. But that whole sequence, this episode really works well, I think, on first viewing and second viewing, because you know what's coming. The second Amos asks if he can fire up the reactor, and I was sitting there. Mm-hmm. I literally was going, oh, in my chair.
Yeah, it's like, you know what's coming the first time you watch it, but, like, you know what's coming the second time you watch it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So this was only one of multiple storylines that we saw progress in these two episodes. We also saw Miller make some serious moves, like, actually, literally, you know, going from Ceres to Eros, and, you know, following his choices after being fired. So for you guys, does Miller become a better character after he stops being like a detective cop person, after he hangs up the hat? Or is that not even an interesting like division? There's no difference in Miller between these two identities or his storyline.
No, I think he does because he's not hemmed in by the whole cop thing, and it's not a cliche anymore. I mean, it still kind of is, but it's less of a cliche if he's not a cop and not trying to get back on the force or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, he's still got this mysterious quest thing going on that is never really explained to my satisfaction. You know, his conversation mm-hmm. with the Mormon about and ultimately coming around in conversation, I think it was with Simatimba, that, you know, he believes in Julie Mao. I still don't know where that belief comes from. But he is sort of on a mission, and he's sort of not hemmed into not only the job, but his self-perception of being a screw-up at the job. He's just mm-hmm. doing the thing now, and that makes him kind of more like Amos than he was before.
Also, in that conversation with the Mormon, I find, and actually throughout the series, I find the fact that the Mormons are out there doing this thing utterly fascinating. It's like, because it totally makes sense if you're a Mormon to do that, to go out to the stars and convert more people. Like, but I find that it's interesting, A, the way they treat Mormons. Like, they aren't jerks to them or anything. This is just a thing they're doing. And B, it's just a fascinating aspect of what's out there. It comes out of left field. You know, you expect space miners and Marines and all that, but you don't expect a starship full of Mormons with the kind of guy with the horn on the top of the ship.
Yeah, and I think having Miller's, like, obsession or quest or whatever with and for Julie kind of paralleled in that conversation with the Mormon made a little bit more sense for me. Like, I maybe wish that had come, or I don't know, maybe if it had come earlier, it would have helped me with his character. But that idea that he's desperate to believe in something and he has chosen this thing, and that's how he, you know, maybe sees religion, and that's how he sees this search. It's all he has left. And it's the thing that's keeping him going. And, like, the fact that character detail, that this is the first time he's ever mm-hmm. left Sirius Station is, like, so, so affecting to me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't know if this, like, that's just such a brave choice, or maybe a desperate choice, or both, I guess, because bravery, I think, often comes out of desperation. But it reminds me of the moment in The Fellowship of the Ring where Sam is like, if we take one more step.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a very different context. It's like, we're going on an adventure versus, like, I'm searching for this woman who might be dead, and I got fired, and I'm so sad. I've never left anywhere in what is space, even. But...
Also, he's this world-weary New York cop feel, but he's a total hick.
Yeah. I think that's the thing that really... I agree that the detail of him having never left really hits me. Maybe because, you know, growing up in a small New England town, knowing people who do, like, never really leave that, I think, does. In that moment, you're like, oh, wow. Like,
he's that guy.
Yeah. And you don't realize he's that guy until that moment. And the fact that he's defined as the station screw-up becomes even more, like, important, I think, when you realize, like, and he's on this station and he's never left, and a bunch of other people have never left, and they're very much defined by these rigid roles because people don't, even though this is, you know, it's a port, there's all these ships coming in and out, there's plenty of people who have no resources to go anywhere else mm-hmm. unless it's an act of desperation.
You know, I just remembered that if I heard his dialogue correctly in the previous episode, you know, when he was talking to his ex, you know, offering her bad advice after she shot the two people, you know, he'd only shot and killed one person. He'd only killed one person before, mm-hmm. period.
Yeah.
And then he came into this situation in the hotel lobby and, you know, killed fairly effectively. I feel like he is sort of coming into his own.
Yeah, and
as a murderer.
Well, it's interesting in the context of our conversation about Amos, and, like, I don't know, he is a very he has some traditionally masculine or, like, machismo driven moves, but he does have a lack of bravado that is, like, rare mm-hmm. for that, the representation of that trait, and maybe for how it exists in real life too. And I think up until this point, or at least until a few episodes ago, the thing that was difficult about Miller was that he did have that bravado that was like such a, feels like a performance maybe. And like seeing this, like him just talking to this Mormon guy, like business traveler or whatever. And feeling like just so like honest and at peace with who he is and like honest with himself. It just, yeah, it's interesting to see that side of him.
I love how after Holden lays a hand on Miller and Miller tells him as they're heading toward Julie's hotel room, and Miller tells Holden to remove his hand or he's basically going to shoot him. And they continue down the hall and Amos just sort of evaluates and gives a nod. Yeah. You know, it's not quite the wink, but, you know, seal of approval. Amos thinks that this is a guy worth being careful with.
It's so true. And I always wonder if those moments are, I mean, it depends obviously on the moment, but when they're written into scripts and when it's a actor's choice. There are a few times in these two episodes, I've heard before or listened to interviews with the actors where they talk about having like Sunday night rehearsals where they like all go over someone's house and like, you know, practice their script rehearse the script for the week. And there were a few times, there was like a Holden Amos conversation that I was like, I can imagine them doing this like on Sunday night. But I think also with something like that, where it's a thing that comes when the actor, potentially, it could be in the script again, because these are very well written scripts, but it also could as easily have been like, I know this character, I care about this character, this is what I think he would do in this moment, and I care enough about the show to, you know, do it, think about these things, whatever. There's an environment that allows me to do it. And yeah, that's such a great moment. A lot of people compare this show to Game of Thrones for various reasons, and I think one of them is the parallel story structure and the way in which you don't necessarily know how things are going to come together, and then they do, and like that moment of satisfaction when it does. So yeah, for you guys, what was it like watching these two storylines merge and seeing these characters that I think you obviously we knew were going to come together because we'd seen it before, but definitely the first time I was surprised in some ways that it seems to just come together all at once. They do a really good job of like holding that reveal, I guess, that they're in the same place until right before it happens.
The fact that it's a crappy motel surprised me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you're like, oh, there's this complete dump of a motel and all of a sudden the shoot happens there, which I guess makes sense, but it's not where I would have expected it to happen.
Although it is very telling of Julie Mao as a character that she probably knows that on some level that she's infected with the proto molecule, and she chooses mm-hmm. not to use any of her money to go to a slightly nicer hotel
and then trash
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Like she's just like, well, I'm, you know, this, I'm going through this terrible thing. I just going to go to the trashiest motel on the station.
Yeah. when Miller comes to the rescue, not only did I not see that coming the first time around, I had a sieve brain moment, and I wasn't expecting it this time around either. So I think that, to your question, Katie, I don't think that I really saw these characters intersecting at any particular point in time, because I felt like I was watching these multiple Game of Thrones style stories. So when they actually do intersect, it was delightful. I was like, oh, wow, they're all on the same page now. They don't know who each other is, but...
but we know.
But yeah.
For lack of a better term, it seems tighter here than Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones seems like a soap opera more than this does, if that makes any sense.
No, I was actually thinking how it takes a lot longer, like a lot longer on Game of Thrones in ways that feel... Like, I remember I read the first three books before seeing the show, and at the end of the third book where some of the characters, two of the storylines almost come together and then don't. And feeling like that mm-hmm. felt almost like, I don't know, like cheap in the opposite direction.
The writer's
you,
a troll.
Yeah, than you usually get. Usually you're like, oh, yeah, they'd run into each other at this place. Like, of course, that doesn't seem realistic. It felt unrealistic in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but also just in terms of, I think that you know, there's something to be said for bringing, if you're having this sort of structure, bringing your storylines together quicker. Because then you can always, you know, split off in other directions too. Just like, there's so many new settings that are introduced in these two episodes, and it just makes the world feel both more real and more expansive. Yeah, in ways that are, I think, add to the richness of the show. There's so much we're responding to in these two episodes, and I think that's one element.
I was so grateful that Alex went through the walkthrough as they were orbiting the Anubis and sort of walks through, okay, here's what we got. This person from the Scopuli was stuck in storage here, broke out.
It was so great.
Turned off the power, vented the ship. I was so grateful for Alex for spelling that out for me.
Yeah.
It was really helpful.
It was.
Also, I really appreciate there's a moment when they're going into Julie Mao's room where Alex turns to Naomi and is like, who's Julie? Like, their clues have led them to the same place, but they have very different pieces of information, and I really like that.
Yeah, it's so good. So we haven't talked yet about Christian, who has a little, like, it's interesting because I don't think I knew the first time I watched these episodes that Christian didn't show up in the first book. Like, I didn't think of these Christian moments as, like, tacked on or, like, unimportant, which is interesting to rewatch them and know that. And I still don't feel that way. But, yeah, we get this Christian, Elise Holden, who is one of Holden's moms. Yeah, great conversation that happens over the course of an entire episode. Did you guys find this interesting? Did you think it felt tacked on? Like, yeah, I don't know. Like, how do you feel, like, what generally, how do you feel about Christian as a character at this point in terms of bringing meaning to this larger story? And, you know, as someone who isn't getting integrated as specifically to the other storylines at this point.
I thought her character was more fleshed out here than she was previously. Like, you know, she talks about her son and but she's also using that to sort of get some parity with this woman and sort of they reach, I guess, a meeting place at some point. And that's Frances Fisher from Titanic, which I found surprising.
Oh. I Googled, that was one of the people I was talking about. I was like, where do I know her from? She's been a mother character.
I saw her
before.
In the name of the credits. I'm like, Frances Fisher, what the hell? And just as a complete side note, one of the things I love about this show is the attention to detail that they don't have to put in, but they do. Like, they glance over at one of the photos on the piano or whatever that is, and it's slightly moving, like a live photo we have now. Mm-hmm. And then just all the ads and stuff they have, like, in various locations, including where that dingy ship Miller is on. Like, just the amount of detail work they put into this show compared to other shows where they just don't even try that hard. You know what I mean? Like Game of Thrones is a good example. There's tons of detail there in the costumes and stuff, but I guess it's a different show, so it'd be done expressed differently. But it just feels like they put that extra 10% in here every time.
Oh yeah, I agree with that. I was talking with a friend who also writes for Den of Geek recently about world building, and the difference between having rules and having logic that, like, ties together. And this is a show that I think does logic really well. And I don't think you necessarily mm-hmm. need to explain all the rules to the audience, but if you know how they fit together and what logic it's serving, then the viewer can feel it and will believe it in a way that they won't if you haven't mapped those things out. So mm-hmm. Or Chip, you mentioned in the show notes that you had a question about, does the Christian Elise Holden conversation pass the Bechdel test, which is usually used as a metric to determine, you know, what female representation looks like in a story. And the rules, basic rules are that it has to be two women having a conversation, and in some versions of this test, they both have to have names about something other than a man. So they're talking, obviously, a lot about Holden, who is a man.
Who is a man? He's a son, but he's still a man.
Yeah. I thought that was an interesting question and an interesting way of thinking about the usefulness of the Bechdel test, which is a discussion that's been had as well. And I guess the ways in which, you know, for me, these characters, and you mentioned this in the show notes as well, these are two older women as well. One of them is a person of color. There's so many ways in which, you know, the Bechdel test doesn't even try to apply these bars or metrics to, or complications to the discussion. Yeah, Jen, did you have a thought about
this? Well, I was going to say the Bechdel test is like the lowest bar that we're trying to stumble over.
Also, I think we've discussed this before, but the show tends to, I don't know if ignore race is the right word, but it seems like they may have solved the problem.
Yeah.
Like, it's just planets that you don't like?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly portrayed more as a class warfare between Earth, Mars, and the Belt, and sort of racial attitudes about people hailing from Earth, Mars, and the Belt. Mm-hmm. I do want to say about Christian and Elise, it's not lost on me that that is a scene that you almost never see in science fiction.
Yeah.
Two older women, one of them not only a person of color, but one of the highest ranking politicians on the planet. The other a mother / activist / landholder, you know, and they're just basically verbally jousting with each other, and they also have opportunities of exposing vulnerability, although Christian does it tactically, you know, because Christian has to win, and exposing her pain for that, as she says, it's not what she usually leads with. But that is one of the things that The Expanse does really, really well. It's a much more colorful tapestry than a lot of shows in that respect. Oh, and speaking of color, Christian's cape.
Oh, it's so good.
Oh yeah, yeah. That is the best look.
Yeah.
That one shot, the whole thing. That opening shot from overhead of her walking towards the whole Holden homestead. That's just magnificent.
I know. In my notes, I wrote like Beauty and the Beast, and then I was like Little Red Riding Hood, and then I just said fairy tale. She just looks so cool.
And she often looks cool, but that is just above and beyond even for her.
I think the combination of the look, which again, we've discussed, she has great looks, and the location, which I think it's pretty rare for me at least to see like fields of snow in television. And I think, you know, because a lot of American or whatever TV films in Canada and in different parts of Canada,
including
than
this
Vancouver,
one. Yeah.
It's becoming more common as those places become like bigger hubs of production. But as someone who grew up in a place that is very cold and had a lot of snow, I kind of get really excited when there's snow in television that I can tell is, you know, actually really snow, which is why one of the many reasons why I love Winona Earp. And they're wearing like actual jackets a lot of the time, although still not warm enough.
To go back to Elise Holden, I think one of the things that elevates the conversation from just being about Holden, which it really is just about Holden ultimately, and a man, I guess, at the Bechdel test. But it's also, it feels very much that, you know, they're kind of talking about her position that she's carved out for herself in this, like, whatever this kind of, like, off-the-grid political power they have. They've carved something out, and she's very much defending that on a level. While she's talking to this person who represents the government. So I think that does add kind of a layer to it, even though the fact that they are kind of talking about their own sons, really. Yeah.
Well, I think we could keep talking about this episode in non-spoilery terms forever, but we must move on. Sorry, first-time watchers. So we are now entering the spoiler zone. For those who haven't watched past episode 8 of the series and do not wish to be spoiled, now is the time to shut off the podcast. I hope you'll come back next week for our discussion of the final two episodes of the first season, Critical Mass and Leviathan Wakes. You can subscribe wherever good podcasts are found and follow us at @legitsalvage on Twitter. For everyone else, let's dive in. So we talked a bit in the non-spoiler portion of the program about the Mormon character we meet in this episode and the depiction of Mormons in this season. But for those of us who have watched past season one, we also have the character of Anna who appears in season three, who is such a great character. And both of these people, you know, one very much a supporting character and one who has a much larger role, are more nuanced and maybe positive depictions of religious figures and religion in modern television than I think we're used to seeing. So Chip had posed this question, does the show have a consistent attitude about religion? And I would love to hear everyone's thoughts on that.
I kind of touched on that before. Yeah, I think in terms of the Mormons are the only ones I can think of who they really, I might be wrong about this, maybe I'm missing something, but the Mormons are the one they touch on the most here anyway, and they seem kind of respectful. I mean, I'm not Mormon, so maybe I'm wrong about that too, but it seems to me they don't treat them as a joke. They've got a thing they're doing, and they get co-opted by what's his name? Why am I so
Johnson.
Terrible with names? Yeah, thank you, Fred
it's
Johnson.
The nouns, I'm telling you.
Yes, but well, in my stupid brain. But
Warren.
They seem well. Anyway, point being, the point being that they seem to treat the Mormon religion with respect, which is a lot more than I could say for many different shows. And they kind of seem to. The only other example that comes close is Battlestar Galactica, the original, because it was written by a Mormon, and the whole idea of the show is based on the Mormon religion to begin with, right? And this isn't that, but it does sort of go, okay, if the Mormons were in space, this is what they would do, and they're probably right about that.
I saw the sci-fi author Ann Leckie speak a couple years ago, and her books have a lot about religion in them, and I really liked she talked about being... I think she's pretty non-religious, but she was said that she felt like often science fiction just acts like we're going to kind of like outgrow religion, or like science will become our religion. And so it is really, and I do think that is like in general often what you see in science fiction is that we kind of like leave Earth and leave religion behind. And even as someone who is not religious, I think it's really interesting to see a show think about how will religion go out into the stars or in the future.
I wonder how much of that is due to like pre-9/11 because 9/11 and what's his name, Francis Fukuyama, that name I know for some reason. him talking about the end of history and then religion coming back in a big way to say, no, that's not the case at all. And it's kind of working that way now. I for one, don't think religion's going anywhere in 200 years. Like people are still going to believe what they want to believe and come up with other stuff that we may not even have come up with yet.
Yeah. There is like, in the books, I don't know. I haven't read the books. I just know what I've read about them. In the books, there's another faction called the Church of Humanity Ascendant that hasn't shown up in the show yet. But there's something else out there. I've compared this show to Babylon 5 before. That show was written by a strong atheist who came out of a cult. A cult Protestant background, but that was a show that had lots of different alien races that had different levels of spirituality and different factions, and really made a point about humanity's large varieties of religions. He has a lineup of representatives of the different religions on the station, and the writer made sure to put the atheist at the head of the line just for just to put up his team first. But on that show, there were lots of different styles of religion. And on this show, I feel like the Mormons, Anna Volovodov, they're all sort of the kinder, gentler sort of, it's almost a bland portrayal of people who have a religious practice of being like super supportive and counselor types. Mm-hmm. And you don't see the potential for fanaticism or narrow-mindedness that much. You see that in the politics, but not in the religion. And I do think that that's interesting. We haven't yet seen the darker side of religion in The Expanse. When it's present, it's kind of mushy, warm feeling and benign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another, and this is kind of going off the reservation a little bit, I remember going, well, why was Nazi Germany so anti-Semitic? What, or just Europe generally at that time? And what I read was, because evolution was introduced as a thing, people didn't go from, like, up to that point, it was like, well, the church says this, so it must be right. But that sort of introduced, well, maybe the church isn't right. But instead of going, let's go with this rational explanation of how biology works, people said, I'm going to come up with even crazier stuff. So that's why anti-Semitism became a thing, because, well, it always been in Europe anyway, but it got encouraged more because people got off into more mystical, actually, it wasn't anti-Semitism, it was more, why was Nazi Germany so into mystical stuff? And that became a thing in Europe at that time because of evolution. So let's say something like the proto-molecule shows up, I guarantee you somebody's going to start a religion about it. They're not going to say, let's, like, to say people just become rational, that's an economist writing a science fiction story, not a human being. People will find a way to come up with something that is completely offside of what you think it's going to be. Like, the way things end up is never the way you think it's going to be, and science fiction authors will be the first to tell you that, actually.
Oh yeah. Or even that there hasn't been some kind of Martian or Belter religion or permutation,
yeah, you'd think,
of,
yeah,
an Earth religion. Seems kind of like that would have happened.
I mean, the Martians seem like libertarians, so you'd think something along those, yeah, lines, like that would kind of, you know what I mean? They sort of do. The Belters, you'd think the Belters being the most hard done by would definitely have a religion as something to console themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it just doesn't come up in the show as... I'm surprised when either the Mormonism comes up, or with Anna in season 3, I'm sort of surprised that those are the only contexts that it comes up in. I'd almost have more expected that the show just ignore religion entirely.
Yeah, because even with Anna's character, it feels so often like she's an outlier. Like, other people are questioning how she is religious or how she could be religious, and she's, you know, taken out of a context of her, like, religious community to a certain extent to go on this trip. And, yeah, I to go back to your point of having, in some ways it is like a maybe, you know, bland, like, generally supportive stereotype of a religious person. I think especially with the Mormon character, who's less of a character. But for Anna, I just love how she... For me, she's a very complex character, and to see, like, goodness and compassion and kindness represented as both brave and complex, I'm really looking forward to rewatching season 3 and her character, because I really liked her the first time, and to watch it specifically with that lens after this conversation, I think is going to be really interesting. Mm-hmm.
And her interactions with Amos, just to bring it back to the beginning of the podcast, that's some good stuff there.
Yeah. I would say, too, it's interesting that her being a lesbian is just kind of accepted as that is a, you know, a Christian religious leader would be that in the future. As much as I want to see the dark side of the religion in this show, I agree, Chip, I also like seeing that as just, well, we've gotten to this point, at least in certain religions in the future.
Yeah, I do take some comfort, without getting into my personal beliefs or anything like that. There are big fights going on in Protestant Christianity and all sorts of other places about abandoning the traditional bigotry against homosexuality, and I'm glad to see my side win in The Expanse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we touched on this briefly before, that this is an episode where we see a few new settings or ideas introduced that will continue to be important moving forward. But that necessarily also means that we're leaving behind some things like Ceres and the characters who are specific to Ceres, like Musser, Havelock. And we also, you know, get to meet or see this new setting of Holden's home and meet his mom. And, you know, Tom makes a brief appearance. But I'm just curious if, for you guys, would you like to see any of those elements brought back again? Or do you expect them to be brought back again? Because we do see Holden at one point sends a message to his mother. But I don't think she comes back again so far.
I mean, there has to be a reason for it, right? It'd be kind of interesting to see a message. Well, this is really spoilery, but they go through the gate or whatever it is in Series 3. And it would be interesting in Series 4 to see if he does, just to tie him back to not halfway across the galaxy, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like when she's mentioning, like, oh, I get a message once a month, or maybe once every 2 months. Like, I'm sure it's gotten a lot less consistent.
Yeah,
and if
so maybe he sends
gate,
one at the beginning of Series 4, yeah.
Yeah, I'm the sort of person who will always be looking for that announcement that in the next season of Doctor Who, Fraser Hines is going to be making a guest appearance.
That would be amazing.
So, wouldn't it though? So I'm enough of a continuity bound nostalgic nerd that I always like to see old elements come forward, but I'm less fussed about it in The Expanse for the same reason that Warren said. You know, there's got to be a reason for it, and this show has been pretty good about leaving stuff behind to move on to the next thing. And I think that that's actually a plus.
Yeah, which I think is historically something that television has done poorly because, you know, up until this period of television, it's very much been about familiarity and structure, you know, partially by necessity in the sense that it's like, these are our sets. This is how, you know, this is our formula. You can't go back and watch episodes. So people need to tune in and know exactly what's going to happen. It's been interesting to see television and television shows transition into something else. And I think a lot of TV shows are still actually, you know, we've mostly transitioned fully into that era, but there's some TV shows that do it better than others. And in The Expanse, perhaps because it's based on a book series that doesn't have the same sorts of logistical, you know, these are the actors we pay. They need to be in every episode, which I think is something that ended up making... being one of the big reasons why later seasons of Game of Thrones aren't as good, because they were like, these are the actors we're paying. These characters need to be in the season. And to see The Expanse not make those same mistakes, or perhaps just be structured in a way that allows those, you know, those characters and elements that we care about the most or that logistically need to appear. Yeah, I don't know. They're just doing a great job. And that's, you know, 3 seasons in, as we've all watched. So I think we all know that we're going to get the Julie-centric episode coming up and seeing things from her point of view. But in these 2 episodes, we, you know, obviously continue to see her through Miller's eyes, and we hear Miller tell Semi that Julie is someone worth saving, and I thought that was an interesting conversation and just an interesting idea. And, you know, knowing what we do about who Julie is, I don't know, that idea of like this is very philosophical and maybe too much for an Expanse podcast, but to discuss within the world of The Expanse, do you think Julie is someone worth saving, or do you think she's someone who's worth saving more than others, and why do you...
I think everybody's worth saving, so yeah, no, I disagree with him on that one. I'm like, why her in particular? Because she's an attractive rich girl? That doesn't seem like a good reason to me, but it seems the kind of reason he'd do.
I think this episode, or the second episode, when they find her body, feels the most the storyline ever feels to, like, the woman in the refrigerator trope of, like, her motivating both Miller and the plot in general. You know, she's doesn't have any agency, right? Like, and we do get the, and I do think that question that Katie asked in an earlier podcast were of, if we knew more about her, would we feel differently? Because at this point, it feels like she just doesn't feel that much like I ever knew enough about her.
Yeah, and we do later. I think it's a series three that they go into flashback, and so, and we get and her dad, you know, who is a monster, but it's also an interesting monster. So there's that as well. But yeah, I just fundamentally disagree with Miller's assumption that some people shouldn't be saved. I don't care who it is; they probably should be saved.
Right. I do think that, and we will have some more flashback stuff with her, like in the next couple of episodes, I think. But I do like the way that they retrace her steps in these two episodes, and we see what she did on the Anubis to try to shut it down and to try to get away and to try to kill the protomolecule. So I found myself feeling a little bit less like she was an object and more of a character that we simply hadn't been watching, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Up until the point when they find her in the hotel room.
Yeah, I do think there is, you know, just to talk about the strengths and weaknesses of television, to go back to that, you know, I think there is something to be said for a character showing up week after week and how that builds a familiarity. Because I'm thinking about Julie's sister, who we meet in season three and who we see interact a lot with Anna. And to me, she's mm-hmm. just someone that, you know, well, she is so much more of a character to me than Julie. And I wish we had had that sort of opportunity with Julie. Because, you know, she does some really terrible, horrific things. She's introduced basically murdering this guy who seems really nice and who's really nice to her. And I still actually end up having a lot of, like, I maybe not sympathy for her, but I understand why she's done what she's done. And, you know, so much of that is because we're seeing her through Anna's eyes. But she does get to be, like, an agent in the story and in this world in a way that I don't think Julie is ever truly allowed to be. And I think a lot of that is because we get to see her in more than just, like, you know, one episode and a teaser at the beginning and these videos. Like, she's so often seen in these, like, you know, the actress is obviously getting paid and is somewhat part of the cast of the show, but she's so often used in, like, this archival footage or the surveillance footage or whatever. Like, it's so often mediated and controlled by Miller. Yeah, it's just, it's tough.
You know, it does pay off in a bit of a way, though, in that hers is the one personality in the protomolecule in the Eros incident, mm-hmm. when she, with Miller's help, convinced the protomolecule or influenced the protomolecule or whatever to crash it into Venus instead of mm-hmm. Earth.
Yeah, but what if it wasn't with Miller's help?
Yeah, good point. Why couldn't she have done it all by herself? Yes.
Mm-hmm. But I am curious to watch those later parts, because I think I remember those. I don't remember those parts well. And especially with us having this discussion, you know, apparently on a weekly basis, which I'm enjoying. I'm excited to especially watch the Julie-centric episode that's coming up. So thank you so much for joining us on A Legitimate Salvage. We'll be back next week to discuss Episode 9, Critical Mass, and Episode 10, Leviathan Wakes. Until then,
watch your shoot.
I'm going to prepare for Plan B.
Welcome to the churn.
Donkey balls.